You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 281, Exodus 16. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing today?
Pretty good. How about you?
Yeah, I've been better, but I'm good. I'm good. Right. Actually, by the time this comes out, it's July now, so we're in the thick of summer. So anything new with you?
Hey, we've had like 9 of the last 10 days here have been under 65, which is just really, I mean, it's unseasonably cold. So like I had a conference meeting with the people in Florida this week, and they're like, yeah, it's 99 here. And I said, hey, I built a fire. You know, it's like, we just couldn't take the cold anymore.
Yeah, it's not the cold that I would worry about, but it's going into that humidity is what I would hate, because it is humid in Jacksonville.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be there in mid-July. You know, so, well, by the time this airs, I may be there. But yeah, we'll get a good dose of it. Yeah, so, cool. You know, it is what it is. I grew up on the East Coast, so I know what humidity is, but the kids do not.
Yeah. It does wonder for my hair, though. So that is one plus.
I'm not going to reap that benefit. So.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, how's the house hunting going?
Oh, they look, you know, nobody's real serious yet because it's too early. But see, now you have me thinking about the hair. I'm wondering if it's going to curl the pug's hair, you know, Norman's hair.
Yeah.
Maury has this short, bristly kind of hair, but Norman, he's fluffy. I wonder if it'll do anything.
You have to take a picture for all of us. All right, Mike.
Well, I'm sure he'll want to do that.
So, all right, Mike. Well, we're in Exodus 16, so we're chugging away. No part one, no part two, A, B, C, D. No. We're just straight up 16.
Yeah, this isn't going to feel like Stranger Things either. This is going to feel like a little bit of Bible trivia here, you know, because this chapter has a number of anachronisms in it. And some of them are sort of more substantial than others. But it takes us into authorship issues and when was this or that part written issues. So it's going to feel a little bit like, you know, I don't know, critical trivia or something like that. But the chapter has, you know, 4 or 5 of these in it. So on the one hand, it's not like we're doing the cool stuff like, you know, trips to Sheol and, you know, all that kind of stuff like we've been doing with the Red Sea crossing. But I think this is still productive because it's really useful, at least in my mind, that people are aware of these sorts of things in the text because, as I've said many times, we need a view of inspiration that accommodates these things, that includes these things in the way we think about how we got the Bible. So I think with respect to that, this is a pretty useful episode because that's kind of where we're going to camp out the whole time. On some of these oddities in the text, and all of them are pretty easy to read over. But once, you know, I point them out, I think our listeners are going to go, oh yeah, you know, well, what's that doing there? So there, again, there's a number of these things. And I do think it's useful again to think about these things as they pop up in the text, because, you know, academic discussions about how we got scripture, which of course, you know, includes the whole, you know, concept of inspiration. The reason why these things are debated and discussed in such detailed, lengthy ways is because of the text itself. So we need a view of inspiration that, you know, going to sound a little goofy. We need a view of inspiration that actually conforms to the biblical text, not some abstract concept that ignores this or is seemingly unaware of these things. So with that said, let's just jump in. So we will go through the whole chapter here, and I'm just going to, you know, read through, and, you know, when we run into things, then we'll hit them when we come to them, and then just stop and discuss them. So the first one's going to come pretty early here. So starting in verse 1, I'm reading ESV. They set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the people of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I am about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily." So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, "At evening, you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning, you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against the Lord." Let me just pause there for a moment. Incidentally, that's kind of a bit of an odd kind of third person reference there, but we'll just keep going. "For what are we that you grumble against us?" And Moses said, "When the Lord gives you in the evening meat to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord has heard your grumbling, that you grumble against him, what are we? Your grumbling is not against us, but against the Lord." And then I'm going to stop there. You know, we go into the episode where Moses and Aaron are speaking to the congregation. But back in verse 4, let me read it again. Here's our first, "Why is that there?" example. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Behold, I am about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not.'" Do you see the issue? There's a reference to the Torah, "walk in my law," Torah. They don't have the law yet. They're not at Sinai. The law hasn't been given. So what is that? You know, is this a reference to the Mosaic law that doesn't exist yet? Well, you know, maybe. But Exodus 15:25, back in the previous chapter, may indicate a more general idea that God gave the people rules before they actually get the law, you know, capital T-H-E, the law. Let me read Exodus 15:25. "And he cried to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a log, and he threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. Then the Lord made for them a statute and a rule, and there he tested them." This is the reference to, you know, the solution to the bitter waters. So the Lord makes for them a statute and a rule, you know. So, you know, God gives them instruction, you could say, before they actually get the law at Sinai. And the fact that the word Torah here shows up doesn't necessarily mean that we have, you know, some anachronism here. Sarna sort of takes that trajectory, and he writes this: "Exodus 15:25 leads us to assume a tradition about laws given before the Sinai revelation." Okay? And if this was the only instance in this chapter, you could say, yeah, okay, I can live with that. You know, God's given them rules before they get like the real rules. And so the fact that the writer would use this kind of vocabulary doesn't mean that we have something really odd here, you know, maybe a boo-boo, where, you know, we reference the law before it actually exists. If this was the only instance of this in this chapter, you could live with that. But as you can tell from what I just said, we are far from that being the only instance of this. Now we get down to verse 9. Let's pick it up there again. "Moses said to Aaron, 'Say to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling.' And as soon as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, 'I have heard the grumbling of the people of Israel. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God. In the evening quail came up and covered the camp, and in the morning dew lay around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as frost on the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, 'What is it?' For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, 'It is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, each one of you, as much as he can eat. You shall take an omer, O-M-E-R, according to the number of the persons that each of you has in his tent. And the people of Israel did so. They gathered, some more and some less. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as he could eat. And Moses said to them, leave no, or let no one leave any of it over till the morning. But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning they gathered it, each as much as he could eat. But when the sun grew hot, it melted. Okay, now listen for what comes next. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers each. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, this is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over lay aside to be kept till the morning. So they laid it aside till the morning, as Moses commanded them, and it did not stink, and there was no worms in it. Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is a Sabbath, there will be none. On the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. Remain each of you in his place. Let no one go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. Now that's reading through verse 29. We're about three quarters of the way through the chapter. Do you see the issue here? We have several references to a day of solemn rest and to specifically a Sabbath. Now, we haven't gotten the Sabbath command yet. And if you think, well, the Sabbath is just something that was part of Israelite culture, think about what you're saying. How would they know about the Sabbath? Well, you say, oh, it's in Genesis, right? Genesis isn't written yet. The same guy who's speaking to them here, who is ostensibly supposed to record the law giving at Sinai, which hasn't happened yet, is also the guy who supposedly wrote Genesis. We have references to the Sabbath before, biblically speaking, anybody even knows what that is. And there are two, this is kind of curious if you actually look it up, there are two and only two references to a seventh day with the command or the comment that it was a day of rest prior to Exodus 20. There's only two times when you have reference to a seventh day before we hit Exodus 20. That's the giving of the Ten Commandments. And those two references are Genesis 2:2-3. Exodus 16:23, which we just read, is the first use of the noun Shabbat, Sabbath, in the entire Torah. Now, if that sounds surprising, yeah, it is surprising, but it's true. So how would they even know what's going on here? How would the people in real time at the event, if Moses is actually speaking these words to the people in the manna incident, Moses is like, well, this is a Sabbath to the Lord. I would think, because the word Sabbath hasn't been used until this chapter in the entire Torah, even if they had a Torah, they might look at him and go, what's that? What? Like, we don't know what you're talking about. I mean, you read through it here, and it looks like they should have known this. But how would they? Now, you could make that, you know, some kind of argument here that you could go either way. I mean, you could hit this hard and fast, like, this is just a hopeless, anachronistic comment here, and the editor's kind of stupid, or the writer. Or you could massage this in some other way, you know, about how, well, you know, maybe they don't have written revelation, but they could have talked about it. And of course, if you go down that road, you're going to say, well, what started the discussion? Who brought it up? Where would anybody have heard this other than the Torah, which doesn't exist yet? And we haven't even had the Sinai event yet. So, okay, in theory, they could have been talking about 6 days and seventh day as rest day, but if you're the people in real time here, where do they get that information? Now, obviously, you could say, well, Moses didn't write this. Somebody living later wrote this. Some would argue Moses, you know, either didn't write it and somebody later did, or you could have the possibility for within the Mosaic composition, the Mosaic authorship tradition, you could say, well, Moses didn't write it like the day after it happened. He wrote it like years, decades later, you know, toward the end of his life, after the Sinai event had occurred, and that means they have this law about the Sabbath, and then Moses is writing this down later, and then sort of, you know, adding it to the details of what happened. But again, that makes us think about some things as well. You know, if you argue that Moses did write it, but at a later time, sometime after the Sinai event, before he dies, then the wording is post-Sinai, of course, reflecting back on the circumstances of the manna episode. That might sound good, but if you give it some thought, if this got written later, what would Moses have said in real time at the event in regard to the manna? I mean, saying he wrote it later presumes that he only knew about the Sabbath at Sinai, which hasn't happened yet. This approach would mean that when the incident actually did happen, Moses couldn't refer to the Sabbath because he'd never heard of it. So then what would he say about not gathering the manna on the seventh day? If he said nothing, then the after-the-fact approach here has Moses making up details of the story later in his life that weren't actually true in real time. You know, Moses had to give the people some rationale for not gathering on the seventh day. And then he changed whatever he said years later in his life to insert the Sabbath stuff. So this particular strategy for sort of saving or preserving Mosaic authorship at a later time gets kind of convoluted. Now, again, you also can't say that the people should have known from Genesis about the seventh day being a day of rest because Moses supposedly wrote that too. So they don't have that either. You know, again, I'm trying to show you how this little observation really, again, raises some kind of fundamental questions or really important questions about, well, what actually happened and when was it written? And the information in the written version of this, how did that get there? You know, like what how did this all come together so that what's written reflects what really happened? You know, if you say that Moses wrote it or somebody else did, again, later, again, like oral tradition, we'll just say, they would have to be, either Moses or this other person would have to be recollecting some original rationale for not gathering the manna, you know, if at the real-time event. But well, again, what would the source of that information be? It seems to me, again, to have this reflect a real event, you need to assume, and that's the key word here, you need to assume that God told Moses about the Sabbath before we get to Sinai. Now, you could read verse 23 sort of that way. This is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow's a day of solemn rest. This is Moses speaking. Tomorrow's a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath of the Lord. Bake what you will bake, boil what you will boil, so on and so forth. So you could say, well, God, you know, not only told them like what to gather and bake and not bake and all this kind of stuff, but God offered him some instruction about the concept of the Sabbath before we ever get to Sinai, which is where the Sabbath is going to become a command. And obviously, this is something Moses could have said in real time, you know, that God just told me to do this. And again, we read it and we assume that Moses just knew this information, like because of Genesis. And we never stop to think, well, Moses wrote that too. And he, you know, like, did that exist? What evidence do we have for that even existing at this time? You know, we never think about questions like this, but critics do. They think about them a lot. So we'd have to go back to verse 23 and more or less say, God and Moses had a conversation. You know, God dropped a few breadcrumbs here about this Sabbath thing, even though, he hasn't, in a Mosaic authorship model, he hasn't prompted Moses to write Genesis yet. He hasn't given Moses the revelation about what happened at creation. He hasn't done any of that. So, but he's dropped enough breadcrumbs here in Moses' skull, so to speak, or in the conversation, so that Moses knows, okay, this is important to God, you know, that we not do stuff on the seventh day. Okay, that's what I'm going to tell the people. And we don't have to assume that Moses knew much more than that. Now, he's going to get more information. And once the Sabbath idea becomes a command handed down at Sinai, the Sinai event, then later in his life, you know, Moses will know what a big deal this was and what the rationale for it was, you know, the creation week and all this kind of stuff. But he doesn't know that now. So you could read verse 23 in that way. I mean, it's a bit odd, but there's no rule against reading verse 23 that way. I mean, there's nothing that forbids it. You know, you could just suppose that the instruction here was more general and it gets codified later. Again, is that a distinction that makes a difference? You know, to some people it is and some people it wouldn't be. But again, I want to point it out that even though it's easy to read this and we never think about these questions, they're actually real questions. And there will be people, again, who have no concern, you know, nothing invested in the idea that Scripture either in any sense, you know, comes from God, either providentially or some, you know, sort of, you know, more spooky, you know, kind of automatic writing kind of thing. You know, I'm using the two ends of the spectrum here, the caricature of inspiration here. Somebody who doesn't care about anything on the spectrum. And, you know, the Bible's just a book. It's a human book put together by humans. And that's the end of the story. There, you know, we don't have to think about providence here or God's role or anything like that. It's a book written by people about God. God really had nothing to do with the content itself. Okay. If you're in that camp, and you know, most, I think it's fair to say most critical scholars are, you're going to notice things like this. And again, if you're mean-spirited, and you happen to have a group of, you know, as a group of freshmen in front of you, or, you know, somebody taking Bible as lit, and you're looking forward to disabusing them of any sense of divine origin for this document they call the Bible, you could pull this one out real easily. So we need to be thinking a little bit better about how these things in the text come together, either at one point or in stages or many hands and all that kind of stuff. This is why I have that short series of lectures that I do about having a better view of inspiration. This is why it's important. We had some of these in the preceding episode, and I think even the episode before that, but this chapter, again, has a number of these. They're easy to miss. They're easy to read over. They're easy to not think about because we have the whole canon. We just assume that Moses has all this in his head, and that Genesis has already been written, or that it's oral tradition. And you could say, well, it could still be oral tradition. Well, sure, you know, it could be. It's just nothing ever got written down. That's possible, but it's an argument from silence. Just like taking verse 23 the way we talked about, that's an argument from silence too. It's possible. You know, we just don't know. But I would say, if it is possible, if it is oral tradition, why do the people have the question? I mean, why did it not occur to them? Why were there some dunderheads in the group that you know went out on the seventh day? Like, well, what's the big deal? I mean, if you would think, if this is an oral tradition that has become intrinsic to the culture, that there wouldn't be a question, there wouldn't be any need to answer the question. But nevertheless, here we are. So. Again, they're just things to think about here. The next item that we're going to run into goes beyond sort of mere words that were verbalized at an event or asking the question what words were verbalized at the event. This one's going to go a bit beyond that and perhaps did not happen, I would say almost of necessity. What's described in Exodus 16 didn't happen when it's described as happening, but did happen later. And so the writer intentionally wants to telegraph some particular point by creating, this is important, the writer himself creates the chronological disconnection. In other words, it's not an error because it's a deliberate literary or theological strategy that was more important to the writer than giving us a play-by-play, blow-by-blow chronology. And that let's just read verses 33 and 34. I stopped at 20. Where did I stop here? Yeah, I stopped at 20, actually at verse 30 here. Let's just, you know, verse 30 was, so the people rested on the seventh day. Now here's verse 31. Now the house of Israel called its name, this stuff on the ground, manna. It was like coriander seed, white. The taste of it was like wafers made with honey. Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omer of it be kept throughout your generations so that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Okay. So we're going to talk about manna in a bit after we get through these anachronisms here. But here's the next one, verses 33 and 34. Now listen to this. And Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept. Two phrases there. Let me read the verses again. Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept. So the two phrases are before the Lord and before the testimony. Basically, everybody in biblical scholarship, because you can just more or less look this up, agrees that the testimony here, Hebrew is edut, refers to the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant is in fact sometimes referred to as the Ark of the Edut, the Ark of the Testimony. Now, covenant is a different word, berit, okay, Ark of the Covenant, but the Ark of the Covenant is called the Ark of the Testimony as well. And so when the testimony, placing something before the testimony, before the Edut is referred to, it's a reference to the Ark of the Covenant. I actually discussed a little, you know, this phrase, this word a little bit in Unseen Realm. Now, Sarna translates the term Edut as pact, P-A-C-T. Okay, and he writes this of this verse, but verse 34. The pact. This is an ellipsis for the Ark of the Pact. Again, what we might think of as the Ark of the Testimony in other translations. Sarna says, Hebrew Edut is synonymous with Berit, covenant, even though they're different words. The Ark housed the two tablets of stone on which the Decalogue was inscribed. These are variously designated the tables or the tablets of the pact. The Hebrew is Lukot Ha-Edut, tablets of the Edut, of the pact, as in Exodus 31:18 and elsewhere, and also called the tablets of the covenant, Lukot Ha-Berit. Let me just stop there. So what Sarna is saying is, look, when you get the tablets, they're called both things, tablets of the covenant, tablets of the berit, and the tablets of the pact, the tablets of the edut, or the tablets of the testimony. So this is evidence that berit and edut, covenant and testimony, or in Sarna's lingo, pact, are synonymous, they overlap in meaning, and the reference in either case is to the Ark of the Covenant, because that's where the tablets were kept, okay? Continuing with Sarna, he references Deuteronomy 9, 9, and 11 there as well. Following the revolt of Korah, Aaron's rod was similarly deposited, quote, before the Lord, that is, before the Edut, for safekeeping and for an educational purpose, as recounted in Numbers 17, 19, 22, and 25. It's the end of the Sarna quote. So clearly, what we have here is when you have this reference to putting something before the Edut, before the testimony, before the pact, it, whatever this is being deposited, this jar is being put before the Ark of the Covenant. Now, what's the problem? It's a very clear problem. The Ark hasn't been built yet. The Ark had not been built yet. That only comes after they get to Sinai. Its construction is given to us in Exodus 25. And frankly, the whole tabernacle doesn't exist yet. Instructions for the tabernacle and its contents are Exodus 25 through 27, a little bit in Exodus 30. This is clearly anachronistic language. You can't say, well, it just means before the Lord, you know, before the presence of the Lord himself, without a tabernacle. You got a problem there. If the deity is invisible, how do you put anything before it? You say, well, you know, maybe it's the mobile cloud or the angel. Well, that's nice. It's a moving target now. What do you keep following the cloud or the angel around, and whenever he stops, you put the jar there at the feet or at the bottom of the cloud. I mean, it's really convoluted, and it ignores the kind of data that Sarna had in his quotation that Edut and Berit are the Ark of the Edut and the Ark of the Berit. They're the same object. This is two ways of referring to the same thing, and it hasn't been built yet. Again, it's a clear anachronism. And again, it goes beyond, you know, what might have been floating around in somebody's head in terms of a conversation or instruction, like the earlier examples. This is something that was either done at that moment or not. And you can't say it was done at that moment because the things that you need to do it don't exist yet. Now, Sarna writes of this. I mean, obviously commentators, this isn't news to them. Sarna writes appendix, this commentary, you know, the appendix, he's referring to verses 33 and 34, actually to the end. of the chapter, which concludes with verse 36, but verses 33 and 34 is where we're at now. He says, this appendix stems from a later time than the events just narrated. It presupposes the erection of the tabernacle, the appointment of a priesthood, the termination of the fall of manna, and that's important. It presupposes that the manna is going to end. It presupposes the settlement in the land and the obsolescence of the Omer measure. Now, that might be a little bit of an odd detail. We'll come back to that, but that's actually interesting too. Sarna writes that medieval Jewish commentators recognize that verses 32 to 34 tell of events that took place later on. It was already well established in rabbinic times that the order of the Pentateuchal narratives does not necessarily conform to chronological sequence. That's true, and we've seen it already before in other instances, where things will be inserted, again, to draw the reader's attention to something deliberately. It's not careless, it's not haphazard, it's designed to trigger a thought in the reader at that particular time. There's something that the writer is trying to either teach the reader or reinforce in the reader's mind. That's why you have these disconnections. And this is going to be another such instance. Now, Durham, in the Word Biblical Commentary, again, notices this, and he writes as follows. He says, this location, again, before the Edut, the testimony, as critics have frequently pointed out, is anachronistically specified here. The testimony, in front of which the jar containing the manna is to be placed, is the testimony of the tablets or the tables of the 10 words, the 10 commandments, or the Ark of the Covenant that contains these tables of the commandments. And of course, neither tables nor commandments nor Ark nor Covenant have made an appearance in the Exodus narrative to this point. Neither, for that matter, apart from this passage, has the institution of the Sabbath, holy to Yahweh, you know, been given, at least as a law. These references, Durham continues, are set here, however, for an important theological purpose which overrides considerations of logical and chronological sequence. Yahweh has proved his presence in his provision for a complaining and disobedient people. That proof, miraculously wrought, must be plain to the descendants of Israel, who have yet to face the struggle of belief. They should share the story of their fathers and also the important evidences of their faith. Thus, the manna is to be kept, one omer of it, one day's supply for one person. It is to be put in a jar and located in a spot before an object anyone reading the passage would know full well. The redactor who made the compilation of Exodus 16 was aware of this and was more interested in the proof and its transmission to the generations than in preserving a chronological and consistent sequence. Now, let me just stop there and unpack that a little bit. What Durham is saying is whoever, you know, is responsible for the final form of Exodus 16 wants his readers living hundreds, you know, centuries later, hundreds of years later than these events, he wants them to mentally connect this jar with the presence of God who preserved their people during the wilderness, you know, period. And so he does that by associating the jar with the place where the presence of the Lord dwelled, which is the Ark of the Covenant. So it's a device designed to teach them a theological point. It may or may not actually correspond to an event in real time at the manna episode, and I would say it couldn't, because the ark hasn't been created yet. Rather, it's a teaching point. It is something that the editor deliberately does, deliberately casts the story this way so that any visitor, you know, I'm using, you know, air quotes now, anyone basically who's living centuries later who would hear about the jar, the manna, or, you know, let's just throw in Aaron's rod and the tablets of the law. You know, but this is the anachronistic example. They're going to know, because those things are stored at the Ark of the Covenant, which is where Yahweh dwells, that the manna was somehow connected to Yahweh. It was something he gave. They can't take a picture of it. They can't take a video of God giving them manna in real time. There's no way to quote-unquote prove the point. And so what the editor does is the best he can. He associates the jar, which people could, in theory, go see, or again, you know, if they knew a priest, a high priest, or whatever, the priest says, yep, it's in there. Or, you know, in theory, they, if it's not mobile anymore, but the tabernacle does get disassembled after the getting of the land during the period of the judges and all this sort of stuff. I mean, people are going to see these objects, you know, a couple hundred years, you know, centuries after the fact, before we even get to the monarchy. They're going to see these objects. And when these things get written down, by juxtaposing the relationship of these objects to each other, the jar with the Ark and the Covenant and whatnot, it's going to telegraph the point that it was God who gave us this manna. And here's the proof. Here's some manna. Here's the jar. It's right in there before the Ark of the Covenant, because that God was the point of origin for it. Again, they don't have any other means to connect these things other than written words. And since the events and the objects didn't coexist at the time, but they were certainly associated, it is the presence of God that lives and sits, you know, on the throne of the Ark of the Covenant, who gave them the manna. Even if the Ark didn't exist at the time of the manna, it was still the same God who did that. They're trying to juxtapose these things in the only way, by the only means they have, and that is writing. And so this is an editorial decision to connect two things that belong together, but were not together in real time. That's what they're doing. That's what the editor's doing here. That's why we have, to us, again, looking back on these things, this is an anachronistic thing in the chapter, but they are nevertheless two things that belong together. Two things that in real time were in fact associated with each other, the presence of God, the power of God, and the manna. And the only way that people are going to be able to sort of visually, or, you know, some other way, you know, sort of, you know, having some kind of proof that these things were connected together, was to connect them literarily in the text that they will have and that will be copied and people hundreds, thousands of years later can read about it. So you, again, this is a good example of having to put yourself in the shoes of a people, Israelites, that don't have any means other than writing something down to quote unquote prove something or preserve a thought, connect two things that belong together, even though, again, in real time, things might not have coexisted. How else are you going to do that? You know, now if they were artists, if you know, if Israel did lots of iconography, and of course they don't, because they don't have a country, okay? They don't have cities, they don't have a temple, they don't have any of this stuff yet. And even in centuries later, in the period of the judges, they still don't have it. Even when they get a monarchy, they don't have it until Solomon. Okay. It's not like they're building things like the Egyptians and they draw pictures all over the walls. They don't have that. This is what they've got. And so this is a good example of putting yourself in the situation and asking yourself, okay, if I'm the editor, this is my editorial project. I got to finish this chapter of you know, the second book of the Torah here. And I want these things connected. And I'm living at a time where we do have, you know, an ark. We do have the temple. And we've got this jar here. And I know the episode, you know, how we got the manna that's in the jar. I know that. But how do I connect these two things? Well, the only way to do that is to just say it. Just put it in the story. Just say it. Because we don't have any real-time movies. Okay? We don't have anything like that. This is why in the Bible, you get some of these chronological disconnections. There's just no way around connecting things for readers other than this. And so, you know, are we going to look at that and blame them for something? It's not a boo-boo. It's not an error. It's a technique. It's a means of communication. But, you know, we on our modern high horses, well, this isn't the way that we would write history. Well, good for us. You know, good for us. You know, we have a bigger data pool. We've got things like video and audio. And, you know, and again, you go back to the whole question, the whole presuppositional question we began the book of Exodus with. If I tasked you with writing a history of your own life, could you do it? Would it conform to your own standards? Okay, get ready to fail, because I'll be a critic on your sources. I know you didn't record in real time all your conversations. I know that you can't go back and find witnesses to events in your life. Even if you could, you don't have those conversations recorded. I can impose your standards on your own recollection of your own life and make it look like you have no idea what you're talking about, dude. I can do that. But we're content to do that with the Bible, at least many people are, and they won't do it to themselves. They won't be consistent because they have an axe to grind. Okay, so yeah, we can get on our high horse here and look at Exodus 16 and somehow poke fun at it or turn it into some mistake or error. It's not a mistake or an error. It is a technique. It's what writers do. It's what they do with the tools at their disposal to accomplish the communicative task that they want to accomplish. That's what it is. So again, this is the kind of discussion that historicity ought to be about. But instead what happens, you know, on the internet, on YouTube, you know, all these sites where people basically talk like they know what they're talking about, okay? All they can do is find disconnections or anachronisms like this and then think they've proven something. They don't put much thought into it at all. They don't impose the same standard on themselves. They don't put themselves in the same time period, the same set of circumstances, because that would require thought. That would require work. It's just easier to grind my axe against this Bible thing, you know, and it is easier to do that. Well, but it's misplaced, you know, it's really inconsistent actually. Now there's one more of these. This is kind of interesting. Let's go to verse 35 here. It's verses 35 and 36. The people of Israel ate the manna 40 years till they came to a habitable land. They ate the manna till they came to the border of the land of Canaan. And then verse 36 in, you know, ESV in parentheses, because it's a parenthetical thought. An omer is the 10th part of an ephah. That's how the chapter ends, with this editorial comment about measurement. An omer is the 10th part of an ephah. You know, look at this. If Moses is writing this, and again, I think you can tell already he's not. How would he know this? How would he know that the people of Israel ate manna 40 years till they came to a habitable land? How did he, how, you know, he might, you know, squeeze that one out because he dies, you know, real close to them getting into the land. But they ate the manna till they came to the border of the land of Canaan. When does the manna actually stop? Joshua 5:12 tells us that. Let me read Joshua 5:12. The manna ceased the day after they ate of the produce of the land, and there was no longer manna for the people of Israel, but they ate of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. Okay, that verse tells us that the manna ended the day after the Passover celebration in the book of Joshua, the first one, at Gilgal, right before the invasion of Jericho. Moses never saw that. He was dead. Okay, again, this isn't a goof on the part of the writer, the editor of Exodus 16. It's deliberate. I mean, he wants us to know. This is obviously added by somebody living later, and he's connecting this thought, you know, again about the manna to what, you know, he's just said really in the previous two verses as well. Now Carpenter notes here, the writer of this note, at least in verse 35, could have been Moses, his scribes, Joshua, or a later inspired editor of his document. The purpose of recapping the entire 40 years in the wilderness was to emphasize that the manna was a constant, it's important, a constant food supply for Israel throughout the wilderness period. Israel could rely on her God to supply her daily needs. God's care never ceased, although the Israelites rebelled against him many times. In a barren desert, God supplied his people with food during a time when a significant amount of time was spent murmuring and rebelling against Yahweh and his chosen leaders. However, this wilderness period becomes at the same time a picture of Israel's glorious past to some writers. For Israel was never more cared for than during this time of great vulnerability and need. It was Israel's childhood when God was forming them into a people. Sarna adds about verse 36, the omer, now catch this little editorial measurement comment, the omer is a measure, or as a measure, never recurs in the Bible outside Exodus 16. This is the only place it's mentioned, the word omer. The note is needed here because the omer became obsolete and unintelligible to later generations of Israelites. A tenth of an ephah is otherwise termed isaron in the Hebrew Bible. The ephah, a word of Egyptian origin, was a dry measure frequently mentioned in the Bible. This is clearly an editorial comment by someone living after the fact, well after the fact. So this little throwaway thing about defining what an omer is, if this was written by someone near the events, they wouldn't have to do that. But since this unit of measurement falls out of use and is never used again in the Hebrew Bible, somebody, again, working the chapter later on, realizes that and says, nobody's going to know what an omer is. Better tell them. Footnote, end of chapter. An omer is the 10th part of an ephah. Oh, okay, I got it now. Again, this is the kind of thing you run into in Scripture. This is an obvious editorial hand. It's obvious that this material is written, you know, later after the fact. And of course, if you connect it, as Joshua 5:12 does, to the Passover at Gilgal, which Moses never saw. Again, this can't be a Mosaic hand, you know, these last few verses at the end here. So again, what we're trying to do here is just to, you know, we're trying to point these out so that you aren't duped. On one hand, you're not duped into taking a view of Mosaic authorship, which some people will marry to inspiration itself. Okay, I don't want you to be duped into taking a view of Mosaic authorship that is indefensible and easily overturned and assaulted. The sorts of simplistic things you hear over the pulpit in many cases in this regard are not helpful. They can actually set listeners up as easy targets for, you know, critical zealots online, you know, militant atheists that, you know, have a video camera and now they're scholars. It's easy to hear simplistic things about the text that just don't conform to the reality of the text. And then when your people, or when, you know, you yourself or somebody you know runs into these things online, they're like paralyzed. Oh, what do I do? My pastor said this. I was always taught that. Well, you know, maybe it was too simplistic of an approach. Maybe the problem isn't the Bible. Maybe the problem is that we need to think better about the Bible. Okay, so that's the one, you know, again, one of the reasons why I bring these things up. I don't want you to be duped. I don't want you to be led astray and junk the faith because, you know, of Exodus 16:36. You know, some later hand put something in about it, what an omer was. Oh, I can't believe an inspiration now because Moses didn't write. It's just ridiculous. I mean, you might be laughing now, but I get emails that you know, where people tell me their stories. And, you know, I was a Christian until, or I left the faith because of, and it's some of the dumbest stuff I've ever heard. Now, it wasn't dumb to them because it had an impact because they were poorly taught. But it's like this would have taken 5 minutes to clear up by somebody who could just think better than wherever they got their information here. And if you're in pastoral leadership, let me just get on my soapbox here a little bit. If you're in pastoral leadership, you owe it to the people under your charge to do some studying and to think better. Because they will come to you as the source, the person who has the answers for their questions. And if you don't have it, again, where are they going to go? They're going to go to Middle Earth. Okay, they're going to go out to YouTube and Google and the internet. And, you know, Lord only knows truly what they're going to find there. You owe it to them. So what can I say? Maybe I'm a little too sensitive to this because I do get those emails, but this is the kind of thing I want to address here. Now, the rest of the episode, this won't take too much time. I want to talk about the manna because there's actually something interesting here going on that might make somebody wonder about what in the world's going on in the text. There's a basic question stemming from Exodus 16:15. So let me go back there. I'm going to read you the verse again. I'll go back to verse 13. In the evening, quail came up and covered the camp, and in the morning, dew lay around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as frost on the ground. Here's verse 15. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" In Hebrew, it's manhu, for they did not know what it was. Moses said to them, "Well, this is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat." Now, ESV has a little footnote next to "what is it?" And this is kind of telling. The footnote says this, or it is manna, Hebrew manhu. You say, "Well, what? That doesn't really mean anything to me." Well, if you know a little bit of Hebrew, you should know that the word for what in Hebrew is not M-A-N. It's not man. It's mah. The text should say mah hu. That would literally mean, what is it? Now, the fact that the ESV puts a note there they take man hu and say, or it should read, it is manna. That hu could be translated it, and then man is manna. It is manna. It gets rid of the question. And when you say, well, why would the translator want to get rid of the question? Because the translator knows that man, M-A-N in Hebrew, is not a question. That word is ma. So the translator of the ESV knows that there's an issue here. There's something funky going on here with, you know, with the Hebrew text. So again, the Net Bible actually gives a kind of an extensive, you know, note on this, but I want to read just a sentence or two from an article here. The article is by Zvi Ron, that's R-O-N, and it's entitled, What Is It? Interpreting Exodus 16:15. It's from the Jewish Bible Quarterly, volume 38, number 4. It's a 2010 article, and it's 7 or 8 pages long, 229 to 236. So he tackles this question. He writes, if the Israelites spoke Hebrew, and since the Hebrew word for what is ma, why did they ask man hu when seeing this food? Based on proper Hebrew, they should have asked ma hu and named the manna ma instead of man. Okay, so that's what his whole article is about. Like, what in the world is going on here? Now, the Net Bible says this. Okay, the text has man hu. Ki lo yadu mahu. See, at the end of the sentence, it actually has the correct, you know, Hebrew word mahu, but it, in the beginning, it has manhu. So manhu, that's the troubling portion. You know, what is it, or it is manna? The ESV footnote. For again, they didn't know what it was mahu. So it's really odd that the second half of the verse has the correct, you know, the quote-unquote, you know, correct Hebrew, and the first half doesn't. So the Net Bible writers, the editors say, from this statement, the name manna was given to the substance. Man, for what, is not found in Hebrew, but appears in Syriac as a contraction of ma-den, what then? In Aramaic and Arabic, man is what? So it shows up in Aramaic and Arabic, but not Hebrew. The word is used here apparently for the sake of etymology. In other words, their suggestion that the writer uses man here to connect it with the noun that will follow later in the chapter, the noun man, which is manna. You know, when it's in noun form. So that's their take. And then they quote Brevard Childs, here's a famous commentary on Exodus, so on and so forth. Childs follows the approach that any connections to words that actually meant what are unnecessary, which is unfortunate because that's the trajectory we're going to follow here in the rest of the episode. Because Childs thinks it's a play on the name, it's a play on words, whatever it may have been, and therefore related only by sound to the term being explained. This, however, presumes, this is the Net Bible editor now, presumes that a substance was known prior to this account, a point that Deuteronomy does not seem to allow. S.R. Driver says that it is not known how early the contraction came into use, this other form, but that this verse seems to reflect it. Probably one must accept that in the early Israelite period, man did in fact mean what. There seems to be sufficient evidence to support this. Now, the Net Bible refers to three sources here. This is getting a little arcane, but I kind of like this stuff, okay? It refers to the El Amarna tablets. One, you know, a tablet and a citation, a line there. It refers to Gordon's Ugaritic textbook, and it refers to the Dictionary of Northwest Semitic Inscriptions. I'll come back to that comparative Semitic stuff in a moment, but for the time being, right here, we have an issue here that man hu, man translated what, does not occur in Hebrew. So what's it doing here in Exodus? You know, how do we resolve this? Now, Ron's article, that article I mentioned a few minutes ago, goes through all the options, and which is why it's of interest. And I will put it in the protected folder for the curious. I'm going to excerpt a couple places from it. He writes, in the JPS, Jewish Publication Society, translation of Exodus 16:15, the phrase man hu is understood to be a question. What is it? Many commentators affirm that the Israelites who said man instead of ma must not have been speaking typical Hebrew at that time. The early medieval sages Rashbam, Yosef Bechor Shor, and Hizkuni explained that man is the Egyptian word for what. And at the same time, or at that time, the Israelites spoke a version of Hebrew that again, in theory, was heavily influenced by Egyptian. But let me just break in here. That's overstated. Now, it's true that, again, for those out in our podcast audience who've had Middle Egyptian, you know, hieroglyphs, okay? If you have access to Faulkner's Concise Dictionary of Middle Egyptian and Gardner's Grammar, Gardner's Sign List, you'll find Mon in those sources. They note the word. It's actually a variant spelling of the normal interrogative pronoun in Egyptian. Again, Ron's article quotes Budge. Budge is a more popular and frankly less accurate Egyptian dictionary lexicon than some of these later ones are. But the later ones do have it. Now, again, I think this is a bit idiosyncratic. It's one word. How can we conclude that the Hebrew of Exodus 16 is, quote, heavily influenced by Egyptian if we're only dealing with one word? Just, I think that's overstated. I think it's kind of unnecessary given something that follows here. So back to Ron's article. He notes that Casuto, Umberto Casuto, was a famous Jewish scholar, written a couple commentaries on Genesis. And, I mean, he's kind of well known in evangelical circles. Casuto gives a similar explanation and writes that in ancient Canaanite languages, the word for mot or for wat is mon. In Ugaritic, remember the Net Bible footnote referenced the Ugaritic textbook. In Ugaritic, it is mn, and in the Canaanite of the El Amarna letters, it is manu. Remember the Net Bible, again, footnote referenced the El Amarna letters. The Israelites then were using an ancient dialect variant for this word. Curid, you know, who we've quoted in a number of times in this series of episodes, Curid prefers this view as well. He says, Mon is an ancient dialect variant found in Canaanite literature, such as in the text at Ugarit, end of quote. And that's all true. You know, I'm sitting here, I have the Dictionary of Northwest Semitic Inscriptions open on my laptop here, and there's lots of occurrences of MN, Mon, in Northwest Semitic languages. You don't get any in epigraphic Hebrew, but all of these languages are related. So in theory, you know, the Hebrews, early Hebrew speakers, you know, could have had this pronoun and this noun as well. I mean, that is very possible. So again, you know, this is what we're dealing with. We don't have any specific examples, but it's very possible. Aramaic and Syriac, these are later, but again, they're in the Semitic family. They have words like man and mana that can mean what. And some scholars will take the Aramaic information, mana, and then they'll go to the early chapters of Daniel where the verb mana, to appoint or something like that, to provide, is used for the food prepared for Daniel. Now, it's not the noun for the food, okay, but this verb is used in what is prepared for Daniel and his companions to eat. And so they go to Daniel and they reason that, well, maybe a later writer or editor borrowed the term to create a pun, you know, with the food itself and the question of what was it and all that kind of stuff. That's possible too. It's very possible. There's another explanation offered by Ron's article. And this gets us into what many of you are probably thinking about the manna, like these naturalistic explanations. So Ron's article covers this ground too. He writes, the Judaic Press translation renders the phrase manhu as a declaration, not a question. Okay, so he first referred to the JPS translation. Now he's dealing with another translation. So there are Jewish translations out there that take it a different way. When the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, it is manna. Okay, so it's not a question, it's a statement. And the ESV had this in a footnote. For they did not know what it was. Accordingly, the Israelites named what they saw, okay, man, because it looked like, this is from Ron's article, because it looked like Tamarix monifera, a sticky sweet substance excreted by scaly insects that feed on the sap of the tarfa tree, a kind of tamarisk, the biblical eshel. This substance contains glucose and protein and has been collected for generations by the Bedouin, who call it man. In many ways, this substance is similar to the biblical manna. It melts in the sun, hardens into white granules, and it can be used as a substitute for honey. It was well known in the ancient world and is mentioned by Josephus, who wrote, quote, it is a mainstay to dwellers in these parts against their dearth of other provisions, unquote. Now, Ron puts that out, say, hey, the Bedouin have this thing called man, too. and it's this stuff secreted by insects, okay? But Ron is fair with the information. He says, you know, there's a problem here. Moses had to explain to the Israelites what they saw was not anything natural. It was from the hand of God. It was not the natural sap-derived mond, but a miraculous substance sent by God. The Israelites named the food they found after the natural mond found in the desert. So what Ron is angling for here is, okay, maybe they used the term for this stuff, but the stuff that the Bedouin collect even today was not what they were eating. What they were eating was delivered by God. So, at best, maybe they borrowed a term. So again, Ron is in his articles trying to cover all the bases here, all the possibilities. He doesn't really fall with that explanation. Again, because he sees this account, Exodus 16. God has to tell him Moses has to tell him what it is. And Moses doesn't say, hey, you see that bug over there? Lots of these bugs secrete this stuff. I know it sounds really, really gross, but it's good. That's not what Moses says. And again, it's this idea of bread from heaven. It has a divine origin, not from insects. So Currid chimes in here about naturalistic explanations for the manna. And he writes, numerous attempts, this one I just read from Ron is just one of several. Numerous attempts have been made to define scientifically the nature of the food. For example, Bodenheimer remarks, quote, accordingly, we find that manna production is a biological phenomenon of the dry deserts and steppes. The liquid honeydew excretion of a number of cicadas, plant lice, and scale insects speedily solidifies by rapid evaporation. From remote times, the resulting sticky and oftentimes granular masses have been collected and called manna. Again, that's what Ron just told us about the Bedouin. Currid continues, such explanations are not sufficient, and they do not precisely fit the biblical descriptions. It is unwise to remove the miraculous element. Manna is, quote, bread from God, Exodus 16:15, also called food from heaven, Psalm 78:24, and the bread of angels, Psalm 78:25. Now, my two cents here, as we wrap up, to me, it makes the best sense to say that Exodus 16:15's wording in the phrase, manhu, is drawn from an older form of Hebrew than biblical Hebrew. Even though we don't have instances, or at least I haven't been able to find any in the Dictionary of Northwest Semitic Inscriptions. I don't know. I can't remember the date of that publication. It's pretty massive, so it's pretty thorough for the time it was written, but maybe there's something else found that didn't make its way in there. I don't have a photographic memory of all Hebrew, epigraphic Hebrew vocabulary here, far from it. But in view of that absence, inscriptions by definition, epigraphic Hebrew, the corpus, the number of them that we have is pretty small. It's a small corpus. And so the fact that we don't have examples doesn't mean that this word, mn, mon, as a pronoun, what, it doesn't mean that that wasn't in their vocabulary. It's in basically all the other Northwest Semitic languages around them, so it probably was. I'm content with that. To me, that makes sense. Mon is an ancient dialect, again, found it occurs in these other dialects, including Ugarit, Canaanite literature, all this stuff. So it's quite conceivable, again, that this was in use for Hebrews in a much earlier period than biblical Hebrew. I'm good with that. I think that's a sufficient explanation. We don't have to, just jump the shark and, go off into all these other lengthy trajectories. But I thought I'd throw some of that in case, again, people out there in the audience are curious. So if you're a newsletter subscriber, you can access Ron's article. It's just R-O-N is his last name. I'll put it in the protected folder. And, for the curious, it's an interesting read. But again, for my purposes, where I come down, I'm content to go with the cognate information here, just the cognate possibility or probability that this was part of the early Hebrew vocabulary. And that in and of itself might be something new to listeners. Hope you realize that biblical Hebrew is not quite the same Hebrew that biblical characters would have been speaking, especially the ones in the early stories. Hebrew is like any other language. It evolves. Biblical Hebrew is sort of like a classical Hebrew. There are differences in inscriptions, stuff that's 10th century. 10th century is the oldest Hebrew inscription that we have. 1000 BC. So biblical Hebrew, by its very nature, is later than that. That doesn't mean that all of the biblical stuff was written after the 10th century, even though most critics would say that. We have an edit. We have updating of the script. The script certainly changed. The grammar changes. The morphological forms change. So you have an updating later on anyway. Put whatever might have existed in early Hebrew into classical Hebrew form. But again, that may be news to some of you. And I'm not suggesting you got to go out and take a class in that or go get a degree, but you should know that some things in the biblical text that are problematic actually get solved because of that. You know, these older forms. And I'm not speaking here specifically of Exodus 16, 15. There are other things as well where this pops up in the biblical text. And if you know, oh, that's just an older form of this or that particle or something, like, oh, okay, I got it. It's not a problem here. That's just is what it is. And either a scribe, you know, when they were updating, again, the form of the language for the Torah, either left it in, didn't care, missed it, you know, whatever. It's intelligible to someone who knows the language from a native perspective, as the scribes did, but maybe not to us unless you go out and get graduate degrees and this kind of thing. So anyway, with that, we'll wrap up. Again, this is a bit more of a curiosity trail in Exodus 16, you know, not the good divine counsel kind of stuff that have been looking at in earlier episodes. But nevertheless, I still think that the information is important. And again, just to jog us into the realization that we need to think well about how we got this thing we call the Bible.
Well, you answered my questions there at the end as far as how old the oldest Hebrew we have. You said it was 1000 BC, dates back. What's the chance of us finding anything older than that?
Well, I think it's reasonable. I mean, it's, you know, it's probably less reasonable in something like Egypt because their civilization was so old and they go around and they build things and the pharaohs say, you know, write great stuff about me everywhere. I mean, there's just more of it to find. But that doesn't mean that, you know, other examples out there aren't, you know, waiting to be discovered. There's certainly no barrier. There's no necessary time barrier to anything like that. So I wouldn't be shocked.
Do you know off the top of your head what the oldest script, I don't even know what you call it, we found is, or, you know, the story behind that?
Well, it depends if you want to lump the Gezer calendar in here, which some older sources will say it's Hebrew. It's probably not Hebrew. Some think of it kind of as a hybrid, but it was used in, it's found at Gezer. Okay. So whoever produced it, and again, there are things about it that dialectically don't work with epigraphic Hebrew. But regardless of that, they're using it at Gezer so they could read it. So what it shows is that Hebrews, people, that's just an agrarian calendar. So it's not like a big military or scribal. You don't need a trained scribe to produce this thing. It's just something you'd use to plant and sow and reap and all that. They could read. Okay, they could do stuff like that as far back as 1000 BC. So it's still worthwhile as evidence, even if there, you know, are niggly problems of it. That, you know, is it true Hebrew or not? Is it a hybrid of something else? You know, who wrote this? It doesn't really matter for what we're talking about. It was used. They could read it. They could produce it. Understand it. So it's that typically gets the nod.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. I like that stuff. All right. Well, chapter 17, on to chapter 17 next week. Can you give us a brief glimpse of what we're going to tackle?
Oh, boy. You know, I really haven't looked that far ahead. I'm still trying to decide. I mean, I think what we see, 17 is not that long. So I think, yes, we will cover 17 because I don't want to jump into 18. So we need to spend a little bit of time there. But then, do I need to do that? Because we actually talked about Exodus 18 when I did that episode, if you remember, on Jesus' use of Psalm 82 in John chapter 10. Because Exodus 18 is the chapter that people go to justify the idea that the Elohim of Psalm 82 are just the Jewish leadership. And so we did a whole episode on that, pointing out the fact that, hey, the elders from Exodus 18 are never called Elohim. Look at that. You know. And so where do we get this idea? But we probably ought to just do the chapter anyway and just talk about Jewish eldership. who are these elders? What do they do? So I think we'll take 17 next time alone and then jump into 18 by itself.
Looking forward to it. All right, Mike, we appreciate it. All right, I just want to thank everybody else out there for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.